The kids can head on out, and the youth can head on out as well. All right, so we are continuing in our journey through 1 Samuel. And let me kind of catch you up a little bit. If you haven't been here in a couple weeks, that's fine. It'll hopefully still make sense today. In fact, we got a real famous story today, so you're going to connect to the story regardless. But I want to give you a little background on kind of where we've been going as we've been traveling through 1 Samuel and these stories. And just to give a little context, and if you want to catch up on anything we've talked about the last couple weeks, obviously you can do that through the podcast and everything like that. But you remember a couple weeks ago we started this, and we started with the prophet Samuel, the final prophet that Israel had. I'm sorry, the final judge that Israel had. That was kind of this go-between between God and God's people, right? This person who could hear from God, who could kind of communicate what God wanted to the people of Israel, who were called to be a little bit different than everyone else. And the people of Israel finally got a little bit anxious about this whole arrangement, especially because Samuel's sons were not exactly up to snuff to take his place when he passed away. And so they were taking bribes and doing all kinds of things they weren't supposed to do. So they got a little nervous, and they finally came to Samuel and said, "Look, appreciate you, but we want to be like everyone else. Like, we want to be like every other nation. Like, we want a king. We want a king and an army, and we want to be like everyone else. And that king's going to fight for us, and he's going to give us everything we ever dreamed of, and that's what we want to do." And Samuel was, of course, perturbed and a little bit personally hurt. And he goes to God with his request, and God says, "You know, don't you be hurt. They're saying no to me, not you," right? Essentially, this is Israel saying, "Hey, let's just go ahead and pretend like you're not actually here, God. You know, let's just act like everyone else. Let's organize ourselves like everyone else. Let's fight like everyone else. No, we'll just feel better about that. So let's just pretend like you're not here." It's kind of like that prodigal son situation, you know, where he has the guts to go up to his dad and says, "Hey, can I have my inheritance now? Like, let's just pretend you're dead, and I just go on living like you're not here anymore." And so it's kind of Israel as a nation doing that to God. And God says, "Tell them, I'll give it to them if that's what they want, because this is what God does often. He's done it with me. He'll say yes to our very bad decisions, because, you know, sometimes we just choose, and God says yes, even if it's a bad idea." He says, "But tell them what's going to happen." And this is what we talked about a couple weeks ago, and he lists everything. And he basically says, if you get a king is going to take, and he just keeps using that word over, and he's going to take your sons, take your daughters, take your land, take your livestock, and he says, and in the end, you're going to be slaves. So that whole thing that I did where we went through the Red Sea and, you know, delivered you from Egypt, that whole Exodus, that great cartoon that I made that you guys saw, like, we're just going to go ahead, you're going to undo that whole thing. And they say, "No, not our king. Our king is going to be much better than those other kings." So we fast forward to last week, and we see that the first king, Saul, is coming near his end of his time, and he has started to do all the things that God said that a king was going to do. And so God says, "My favor is no longer on this king, Saul. I'm choosing someone else." And he sends Samuel to go anoint someone else king while Saul is still king, which is a terrible life decision to do that to a king, because they don't like it very much. And Samuel's nervous about it, but he sends him and he says, I'll let you go talk to one of the sons of Jesse. I'm going to choose one of them." And so we had this great scene last week. We described like a biblical episode of The Bachelor, right? And so Samuel shows up, and there's all these good-looking candidates, and God keeps saying, you know, goes to the oldest, best-looking one, strongest one, and says, "Nope, that's not him. Nope, that's not him." Goes down the line, all seven of these sons, nope, "You don't get a rose, you don't get a rose, you don't get a rose." And they weren't actually handing out roses. And then Samuel finally says, "Well, I mean, is this all your sons? Because God was pretty clear about it being one of your sons." He said, "Well, I mean, there's the youngest one, but he's out with the sheep, you know, where he belongs, not in here. You don't know him. I know him. He's not supposed to be here." He says, "Well, go get him." So remember, then there's this long, awkward scene, right, where someone's got to go out to whatever field he's at, wherever he's at, go find him, bring him back in, get him all cleaned up and purified to come into the sacrificial stuff they were doing. And he's got to sit in there and wait with the seven guys you just said no to, right? Very awkward. I don't know, if you've ever had to spend time with someone you just broke up with. No fun. And then God says, "That's the one," right? The Bible says, you know, he's a handsome little guy, but he's small. He's a runt. Like, he's not the one that you choose, right? And last week we talked about that whole thing that's going on there, and how what God says to Samuel is, "Look, don't look with your eyes, look with my eyes," right? God does not see things like man sees things. And it was played out, what we talked about last week. It was played out with Samuel. In the whole first part of the thing, he's looking backwards at the fact that Saul didn't work out. Everything he invested in King Saul and how much he wanted to work, and he's grieving over this thing. And God's saying, "Hey, get up and let's go. You know, we're moving on." Samuel looks backward, God looks forward. So we talked about that idea of trying to see with God's eyes, looking forward. And then also that God does not value the same things we do. It says that God sees, like, the heart. God sees what's most important about someone, not all the superficial and superficial things that we put so much stock in that don't matter at all. And so we talked last week about trying to see with God's eyes. And ultimately, at the end of that story, we have this little boy who no one would expect, who's been anointed the next king of Israel, but Saul just doesn't know yet. Like, Saul doesn't realize he's been broken up with, right? And the next one's already been chosen. Well, and then you come into this story, and this story is great because Saul still doesn't know what's happening. And what ends up happening in this is basically Saul sets up David to just kind of further his own claim towards the throne in some ways. And this story this week is one of the most famous stories really in all of Scripture. In fact, we talk about David and Goliath, whether someone's ever been to church or not, whether someone considers themselves religious or not, it's a motif, right? I mean, if you watch the movie Rudy, and someone's going to say, well, it's a David and Goliath story, right? I mean, it's its own type of story, right? And so what I want to do is kind of read through this. Now here's the hard part for us. I think we may cover more verses in one week than we've ever done ever here, because as you all know, I can kind of tend to fixate on the trees instead of the forest sometimes. And we've got like 50 verses that cover the story. And I was just going to pull out just the part that I'm going to kind of focus on, but it's a great story. So if it's all right with you guys, I'm just going to read through this entire story here. And then no matter how bad the sermon is, at least you hear a good biblical story, right? You can't complain too much because most of the sermon is going to be Scripture. So if you're complaining about it, talk to God, not me. So let's just go ahead and read through the story. We'll put it on the screen, although it's a lot to keep up with on the screen. Again, it's 1 Samuel 17, if you want to open the Blue Bibles. I forgot to look up the page number, but you can find it. And here's what it says. Saul and the Israelite army assembled and camped on the Elah Valley, where they got organized to fight the Philistines. The Philistines took position on one hill, while Israel took position on the opposite hill. And there was a valley between them. So they're both up on the hill, there's a valley between them. A champion named Goliath from Gath came out from the Philistine camp. He was more than 9 feet tall. Now, if you play around with the Hebrew and you've had all these different scholars trying to figure it out, most scholars now say he's probably about 6'7" to 6'9". But by standards back then, like, gigantic, right? And there's all kinds of theories about whether he had some kind of, gland issue or something now, because there's indications he may not see real well later on, where like he's who knows? But anyways, big, tall, scary dude. Just imagine that. Whoever that kid was in your junior high that scared you to death, just think of him. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore bronze-scaled armor weighing 125 pounds. So a strong dude. He's carrying around 125 pounds to fight in. He had bronze plates on his shins and a bronze scimitar hung on his back. His spear shaft was as strong as the bar on a weaver's loom. And we all know how strong that is. And its iron head weighed 15 pounds. His shield bearer walked in front of him. By the way, maybe the worst job of all time. Like, as I'm reading the story and you realize, like, here's this giant, you got all this weaponry, like, I'm going to march into war. Okay, you walk in front of me. Like, no, I don't want to walk in front of that guy. That could not have been a very long career for anybody who did that. He stopped and shouted to the Israelite troops, "Why have you come and taken up battle formations? I am the Philistine champion, and you are Saul's servants. Isn't that right? Select one of your men and let him come down against me. If he is able to fight me and kill me, then we will become your slaves. But if I overcome him and kill him, then you will become one of our slaves and you will serve us. I insult Israel's troops today." I love that. Like, just in case you're unclear, I insult you. Like, it's just, I love that. I love how direct that is. Very Monty Python-ish. I insult you, in Israel troops today. The Philistine continued, "Give me an opponent and we'll fight." When Saul and all of Israel heard what the Philistine said, they were distressed and terrified. So they're on these two hills. There's a valley between them. This giant of a man with, like, decked out, who's the champion among the Philistines, comes out and says, "Look, let's not get into this whole thing where both of our armies get into formations and tons of people die on both sides. Bring out your best man, we'll bring out our best man, and we'll settle it right here." And this was not an altogether uncommon thing back then. And you can imagine, really, as you know, if you think about the kind of hand-to-hand bloodshed that would happen in a war back then, there was no distance, it was nasty stuff. And even if you won, you lost. You lost a lot of people. So this is actually a pretty great way to kind of settle things in a lot of ways. It saves a lot of lives. And so this wasn't altogether unusual. So he comes out. He's crazy intimidating. He's the champ. No one wants to tangle with him, and he challenges them and insults them directly and says, "Bring someone out and we'll do this." But everyone's terrified. What we find out, I'm getting ready to skip a few verses, is David's father sends him out to the troops to bring some food and some cheese and stuff, because that's what David's all, he's good for, right? He's a kid that's out with the sheep. So he's delivering food and ends up near the front lines to see his brothers. That's where we pick up in verse 20. So David got up early in the morning, left someone in charge of the flock, and loaded up and left just as his father Jesse had instructed him. He reached the camp right when the army was taking up their battle formations and shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines took up their battle formations opposite each other. David left his things with an attendant and ran to the front line. When he arrived, he asked how his brothers were doing. Right when David was speaking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came forward from the Philistine ranks and said the same things he had said before. David listened. When the Israelites saw Goliath, every one of them ran away terrified of him. Now the Israelite soldiers had been saying to each other, "Do you see this man who keeps coming out, how he comes to insult Israel? The king will reward with great riches whoever kills that man. The king will give his own daughter to him and make his household exempt from taxes in Israel," right? Someone slays this guy, no more taxes, and you get his daughter. I mean, it's a pretty good deal. So you're like, man, somebody should do that, right? David asked the soldiers standing by, "What will be done for the person who kills that Philistine over there and removes this insult from Israel? Who is that uncircumcised Philistine anyway that he can get away with insulting the army of the living God?" That's my new cut down, by the way. I'm going to go with this. When someone like cuts me off in traffic or anything, I'm just going to call him an uncircumcised Philistine. I think it's got a lot of teeth to it. Then the troops repeated to him that they had been saying, don't actually do that, please, in real life. You're going to get beat up if you say that. People won't know what you mean, but they're still going to be mad. Then the troops repeated to him what they had been saying. "So that's what will be done for the man who kills him," they said. Then David's oldest brother, Eliab, heard him talking to the soldiers and got very mad at David. "Why did you come down here?" he said. "Who was watching those few sheep for you in the wilderness? I know how arrogant you are and your devious plan. You came down just to see the battle." "What did I do wrong this time?" David replied. "It was just a question." Again, I love this little section because you see a whole lot of, you guys have brothers and sisters, you see a whole lot of family dynamic happening in just two little lines here, right? Like, what are you doing down here? I know what you're up to. Get out to your few little sheep and take care of, what did I do? I was just asking a question. Like, this is a great older brother, younger brother kind of inner exchange here. "What did I do wrong this time?" David replied. "It was just a question." So David turned to someone else and asked them the same thing, and the people said the same thing in reply. The things David had said were overheard and reported to Saul, who then sent for him. So now King Saul is calling David, who he has no idea has been anointed to be the king later, to find out what this kid is going up and asking all these questions is talking about. And this is what David says to him. "Don't let anyone lose courage because of this Philistine," David told Saul. "I, your servant, will go out and fight him." You can't go out and fight this Philistine," Saul answered David. "You are still a boy, and this guy has been a warrior since he was a boy." "Your servant has kept his father's sheep," David replied to Saul. "And if ever a lion or a bear came and carried off one of the flock, I would go after it, strike it, and rescue the animal from its mouth. If it turned on me, I would grab it at its jaw, strike it, and kill it. Your servant has fought both lions and bears. This uncircumcised Philistine will be just like one of them because he has insulted the army of the living God. The Lord," David added, "who rescued me from the power of both lions and bears, will rescue me from the power of the Philistine." "Go," Saul said to David, "and may the Lord be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own gear, putting a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David strapped his sword on over the armor, but he couldn't walk around well because he'd never tried it before. "I can't walk like this," David told Saul, "because I've never tried it before." So he took them off. He then grabbed his staff, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream bed. He put them in the pocket of his shepherd's bag with a sling in hand and went out to the Philistine. So he finally says yes to him, this cocky little kid. He says, "I'm going to go out there and take care of him." He says yes to him, so he dresses him up the way you're supposed to dress for this kind of battle. And David says, "Nah, I can't move around in this." Takes all of it off, is just dressed like a little shepherd boy, gets these 5 stones, heads out there, and went out to the Philistine. Philistine got closer and closer to David. His shield bearer was in front of him. Again, this is where some people think he had bad eyesight, so he's being guided by this guy kind of thing. And, you know, you just don't want to get within arm's reach of him or something. Who knows if that's true, but that's what some people think. Shield bearer was in front of him. When the Philistine looked David over, he sneered at David because he was just a boy, reddish brown and good looking. The Philistine said to David, am I some sort of dog that you would come to me with sticks? And he cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said to David, and I'll feed your flesh to the wild birds and the wild animals. But David told the Philistine, "You are coming against me with sword, spear, and scimitar, but I come against you in the name of the Lord of heavenly forces, the God of Israel's army, the one you've insulted. Today the Lord will hand you over to me. I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will feed your dead body and the dead body of the entire Philistine camp to the wild birds and wild animals. And the whole world will know that there is a God on Israel's side. And all those gathered here will know that the Lord doesn't save by means of sword and spear. The Lord owns this war, and he will hand all of you over to us." For a shepherd, he's got some serious smack talk, doesn't he? I mean, that's some good stuff. That's some good smack talk. The Philistine got up and moved closer to attack David, and David ran quickly to the front line to face him. David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone. He slung it and hit the Philistine in his forehead. The stone penetrated his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. And that's how David triumphed over the Philistine, with just a sling and a stone, striking the Philistine down and killing him. And David didn't even have a sword. Then David ran, stood over the Philistine. He grabbed the Philistine's sword, drew it from its sheath, and finished him off. Then David cut off the Philistine's head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they fled. Do you blame them? I mean, can you imagine that? So can you imagine watching that happen from a distance? This little shepherd kid just knock down your hero and then cut off his head. Like, I would be running too. And they fled. The soldiers from Israel and Judah jumped up with a shout and chased the Philistines all the way down to Gath and the gates of Ekron. The dead Philistines were littered along the Sherim road all the way to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites came back from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put the Philistines' weapons in his own tent. I'm not sure why I kept the weapons. I doubt he could probably even lift them. So you have this amazing, again, this, I mean, if there ever was a David and Goliath story, it is this one, right? This whole image of this unexpected small underdog who steps in and does this amazing thing. And as I'm reading through the story this week, I'm thinking, man, there are so many different kind of paths you can take, because I think the main thing that this story is trying to connect to us is that there is something vastly different about David. There's these armies of people, and then there's this one guy who's not like any of them. And so as I began to kind of think about this, there's a story of how God does amazing things with small and unexpected people, but what really separates David out from the crowd here? And there's a few things I think we could talk about. And there's one main one I want to talk about, but you could talk about just willingness, right? I mean, David is willing. He'll get out there. He will do it. And the older I get, the more time I spend, in this story, and the more time I spend in my life kind of trying to do the things and work in the ways I do, I'm convinced that unwillingness is one of life's great hurdles. I mean, just not being willing to actually do something. I'm finding that trying to find someone with a grand opinion about what should be done is exceedingly easy, right? It is not hard to find someone that has really big opinions on what we should do. In fact, I'd imagine if you opened up your Facebook right now on your phone, don't, but if you did, I'd imagine that probably the 6 out of the first 10 posts is going to be someone very, very strongly declaring what we should do or what this person should do, right? They're the most common people in the world. Even if someone's opinions may be very unique, even if someone's opinion is really well thought out, even if that opinion is entirely correct, which it rarely is, but even if it was, it's only about what we should do. It's all potential energy, no kinetic energy, which means it actually makes potentially exactly zero difference in the world, right? Their thoughts about what someone should do, what some group of people should do. It's an act of opinion. It's not an act of will. It's not being willing to do something. It's having opinion about what we should do. And I don't know about you, but as time goes on, I realize that the world is full of these kind of folks. I am often one of these kind of folks. But really, the world needs a few less people that are shoulding all over the place. Can we just say it like that? Give me one person who's willing to do something over 100 people who know what everyone should do. Are you guys with me on that? You guys work with these kind of folks. You guys kind of spend time. Give me one person who's willing to get out there and do something over 100 people who knows exactly what should be done. Because the whole army's sitting there. Man, someone should fight this Goliath. Man, someone should kill this guy. Someone should be honored, and someone should get a reward from the king, and they should not pay taxes anymore, and they should get the king's daughter, and they should, man, someone should win this war for Israel. And David says, I will. Right? David is willing. It's amazing what God can do, and this is an important part of the story, an important thing for us to realize. It's amazing what God will do with someone who's just willing, instead of just standing there shooting. God can do so much with someone who will use their will, their efforts, and their strength to actually do something. So that's one thing that separates him out. He's willing. The other thing, I mean, I think we could talk about is the kind of the benefits of traveling light. I mean, I think there's something to be said about the manner in which he goes out to this fight. Right? One of the things that can often keep us from entering whatever fight we're called into is that we don't tend to travel very light. You know, and David gets loaded down with all this stuff and says, nah, don't want it. And it enables him to run quickly and to do the things that he does. The more we gather, the more we carry, the more we have to protect, the more we have to lug around, the harder it is to answer the fight. Right? There was a time in my life when all I owned could fit in the back of a Honda Accord hatchback, 87 hatchback. Everything I owned could fit in there. And I could get up, I mean, once I scooted aside all the women wanting to ride in that car just for status, once I got them all out of the way, I could jump in that car and go wherever I wanted and do whatever I felt like I wanted to do, right? And in a real sense, that freed me up to do things I never would have been able to do otherwise. Now, I'm not saying, I'm glad to have a wife and a child. I'm glad to have a home. Those are good things. I believe in planting yourself in a community and staying there. I'm not saying that we need to be transient all the time. But there's something to be said about not gathering so much all the time, right? I mean, the more stuff I buy, the more stuff I gather, the more I've got to take care of, the more I've got to protect, the more that's at risk if I feel called to do something that may be out on the edge a little bit. There's something to be said about traveling light. I think there's probably a reason why Jesus always sent his disciples out, mostly empty-handed. Not unlike David, the more I have to carry, the less effective I can be at responding to the call to whatever fight I'm called to go into. So David is willing, David is traveling light, and those are both very good things and worth considering. But I think there's one thing that both of those things are really born from, and that's really what I want to get at tonight. I think the thing that really separates David in this story is David is the one person who still acts like God is living and active in this world. David is the one person who still acts like God is alive and acting in this world. Remember, Israel has essentially behaved like God is no longer real, right? We don't want you anymore as our king. We want our own king. We want our own army. We want to act like everyone else. We want to pretend like you are not here. Give us a king with flesh that I can see in front of us, with gold that I can admire in front of me to lead me. I want an army that I see and I can hear to defend me. They now want to fight like God has not interceded for them in the past. Like God is not living and active in their world anymore. And since they've decided to act like God is not real anymore, God is not active in their world anymore, consequently, there is nothing beyond what they can see right in front of them. And what they see right in front of them is very scary. But remember, God does not see things as we see things. And now the army of Israel does not see with God's eyes. They just see a huge warrior with a loud mouth who looks unbeatable, and they act accordingly. Because that's all there is to this situation. I mean, did you notice in the reading, did you pick up on David's sense of kind of, he's almost naive sounding, right? It's this like mix of indignancy with bewilderment at the way everyone's acting. I mean, he says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine anyways that he thinks he can get away with insulting the army of the living God? I mean, this little shepherd is out there going, why is everyone just standing here? Like, who is this guy? Who does he think he is, right? He says to the king of all of Israel, don't let anyone lose courage because of the Philistine, David told Saul. I'll go fight him, right? I, your servant, will go and fight him. There's this sense of kind of indignance that he has of like, if God is real, if God is who God said he is, then why are we all waiting on this? Why isn't someone going out and doing something about it? David is that guy that kind of walks into this kind of collective fear and casually volunteers to go first in a way that kind of makes all of us feel bad about ourselves, right? I remember all of us standing at the community pool when we were little, and it was the pool with the high dive. And we'd seen all the older kids go off the high dive. and we really wanted to go off of it. But the problem with the high dive is it's really high and it's scary. And you think 10 feet's not that big a deal, but when you're, you know, 4 foot, 10 feet is tall, right? It's big. And so I remember all of us kind of, that were our age group kind of sitting around and going, look at that thing, being like, yeah, I'm gonna jump off that at some point. You know, yeah, someone should just do a flip off that. That'd be awesome. You know, a lot of, you know, a lot of should, would, all this kind of stuff. And then we had that one friend who just kind of showed up, a kid that was close to our age. I don't know if he'd done it before or not. That was just like, oh, I'm gonna go off the high dive, and just walked up and jumped off, right? And just shamed all of us. So then all of us suddenly were super courageous. I mean, inside I was still freaking out. But I was now shamed into being brave, right? Because he just acted like, oh, this is no big deal. This is just what you do. And David is that guy. You can understand why his brothers probably didn't like him much. He just walks up and says, I'll do it. What creates that kind of spirit for him? Because David is working from the assumption. David believes, has that conviction of, and then just acts naturally from that conviction that God is actually there. God's going to do something. God said he would, and so God will. And since God is actually going to keep his promises to me, he just acts accordingly. Him going out and fighting this giant is not an act of bravery. It's the logical extension of believing that God is real. Why wouldn't you? And that's kind of the attitude he has. Why is no one going out there? This guy's insulting the army of God. The term we use for this conviction in religious circles a lot of time is faith. Hebrews 11:1 defines faith as this. Faith is the reality of what we hope for and the proof of what we don't see. The reality of what we hope for and the proof of what we don't see. It is behaving like the things that we believe, even if we can't actually see them, are reality. And David has faith. He believes God is going to do something, and so he acts accordingly. David acts from the conviction that what he can't see is still very true. And really, I would argue just about anything that we do as followers of Christ is in some way an act of faith, right? Studying and following a guy who lived 2,000 years ago doesn't make much sense apart from faith. Trying to love unconditionally seems on its surface to be a terrible idea. Living like the kingdom of God is the most true thing, even though it hasn't been fully realized yet in flesh and blood in front of us, seems insane, unless faith. Unless we actually believe God is real, God is acting, God is redeeming, God is building, God is here and doing something. Unless we live as if it's true. And that's what it means to have faith. It means to live as if it's actually true. To have faith is to live as if. To live as if each person is made in the image of God and has inherent worth as God's own beloved child. To live as if peacemaking is more effective and a better choice than violence. As if generosity is better than hoarding for ourselves. As if love is better than hate. As if moth and rust really do destroy most of what the world values. As if love can be unconditional and forgiveness can be freely offered every day. As if God is actually real, actually living, actually doing something in this world. Faith is living as if. And that's what David does that you don't see from anyone else in the story. That's all he really has. If you haven't done it yet, do yourself a favor and watch and listen to the video of those left behind after the church shooting from this last week as they confront the person who did it. Has anyone seen that video yet? It's incredible. I mean, there is no words for that kind of act, right? I mean, we hear that kind of thing, and who knows how to process something like that? And yet, when he gets in front of the court, they asked for time to talk directly to the guy that just killed their pastor, killed their family, killed their friends, and after they had welcomed him in to their community. And to a person, every single one of them forgave him. Said, I forgive you. Through their tears, through their pain, through their anger, they lived as if, in that moment, they lived as if forgiveness is better than revenge, no matter how good revenge would feel. They lived as if love was better than hate, as if redemption and forgiveness is actually available to everyone, even that worst person that you can possibly think of. We think of how can you face down that giant of anger and hatred and hurt and revenge? How do you face down that kind of giant? You face it as if God's grace is real, as if God is actually there, as if God actually redeems even the worst of our own souls and of our humanity. You live as if. That is faith. What those folks did in that moment makes no sense. They're just acting as if God is real. And the hard question that I was left with, and that's kind of what I want to end on tonight. And this is one of those questions, because it's bothered me all week and I've been kind of wrestling with it, that I could potentially put it out there and you could, it could be, this is one of those questions that could be used as a weapon to beat you up, and that's not the intent. So please don't take it that way. I've done a little bit of beating up on myself over this, but I think it's worthy of us asking ourselves. The hard question I ended up asking myself this week as I was thinking through this idea of living as if, I began to ask, can I honestly say, or what part of my life can I, honestly say is lived as if all of it is true? Or to put it another way, we can say this. Is there any part of my life that makes no sense apart from the conviction that God is actually alive and working? Is there anything in my life that someone who does not work from that conviction, that does not understand God in the same way I do, would look at my life and say, that makes no sense? Are there any of those David-like moments in my life, places in my life, where the only way it makes sense is as if me living as if God is actually real? And if the answer is no to that, if there's no part of my life that is like that, then that's probably worth considering. Because then the question is, what does faith really mean for me? Is this just really an exercise of me feeling obligated to do something every Sunday or be a part of something because that's what I was? Is this just religion? What is this exactly? Because if there's no part of our life that's lived as if, then I'm not sure we can really call it faith, right? If the answer is no, then I'm more like those older brothers of the whole army of Israel. I'm more like the people that are shooting all over themselves in the world. Or am I more like David? Can I genuinely say that I live my life as if God actually is real, as if God actually means what God says, as if God is actually doing what God says God is doing? Each Sunday, we like to take some time in silence. We usually do it at the beginning of prayer. Tonight, I want to do it now. And I want to just leave that question hanging out there for us to kind of think about. If you want to pull out a pencil and paper and write something down, or if you just want to kind of focus on that question for a minute, I'm going to close in prayer and then lead us into the communion time in a second. But let's take a few moments in silence to consider whether or not we are really living our lives as if God is real. Again, if you're with us for the first time, we're especially glad to have you. And we hope that you know that no matter who you are, where you're coming from, no matter what's going on in your life, you're welcome here. You're welcome to be a part of this community, and we're better off with you in the room, and we hope we'll see you again. If you want to be kept up to date with what goes on in this community, the best way is to get us your email address. You can fill out one of those cards, get us your email address, put it in that plastic box by the back door. We'll add you to the list. If you have any gifts for the ministries of this community, you can put them in there as well, and we'll put them to good use. Don't forget, next week, we're doing food for Hope House. And don't forget to talk to Sharon if you've got some time during the day that you'd like to help out with what's going on at Hawkins. But thank you so much for being here. And as we leave this place, may we open ourselves up to being a people of faith. May we walk into this world, and despite how things may look in front of us, despite how large the giants might be that loom on the horizon, may we be a people who live as if God is real and God is working. Peace be with you. Have a great week. Thanks for being here. Right here.